Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is our final show for the year 2013, and we have conducted over 20 shows on myeloma, and these have been heard over 30,000 times by our supporters. We have been fortunate enough to feature eminent myeloma experts, including Dr. Paul Richardson, Dr. Robert Olivetsky, Dr. Shajit Kumar on the show, and we have been overwhelmed with the support that we have received from our panelists, Gary Peterson, Pat Killingsworth, Jack Aiello, Nick Van Dyke, Cynthia Shmilevsky, Lizzie Smith, and our participants and supporters who have been with us through this myeloma journey. We have quite a few interesting shows lined up for you in the coming new year too, and hope you enjoy your support to bring you the latest from the field of myeloma research. All details of our upcoming shows can now be accessed at curepanel.carefeet.net, or you can always email me, priya@trilex.com. Today's is the 40th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show. Our previous episode on myeloma had Dr. Ashok Chanan Khan of Mayo Clinic discuss monoclonal antibody therapies in myeloma. Today, we have a very distinguished myeloma expert joining us. My co-host for the evening is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. Supporting Gary on the panel are myeloma survivors and advocates Pat Killingsworth, Jack Aiello, Nick Van Dyke, and Cynthia Shmilevsky. Today we are discussing total therapy for myeloma. Total therapy is the only program in the world that seems to talk about a cure for myeloma. Total therapy is based on the approach that the best chance of eliminating all disease is at the beginning of treatment, when the cancer has not been exposed to any drugs and has not developed any resistance. As Gary Peterson mentions on his website, MyelomaSurvival.com, the most recent data on total therapy shows average life expectancy of 15 years for their TT3 program, and this is 3.8 times longer than the average of all the facilities that report their survival to the National Cancer Institute. To learn more about total therapy, stay tuned. I will now hand over to Gary Peterson, who will introduce us to the expert and begin with the show. Gary, you're live.
Yes. What I'd love to do right now is to introduce everybody to Dr. Fritz Van Rie. He is internationally known multiple myeloma researcher and a professor of medicine at the University of Arkansas Medical Sciences College of Medicine. And he's also the director of developmental and translational medicine in the Myeloma Institute. He became the inaugural recipient of the Charles and Clydine Charlar Chair for Hematological Malignancies and Research. And this particular chair had been funded with a $1 million donation from one of the people being treated at UAMS. He joined the Myeloma Institute in 2001, establishing a laboratory for developing innovative medical treatments using the body's immune system. He is a leader of multiple National Cancer Institute-funded grant programs and projects related to the developmental therapeutics and anti-myeloma effect of natural killer cells in the body's immune system. He has an exceptional background with earning his degree in medicine in the Netherlands, then continued education at the University Hospital at Oxford, and also at the College of Science, Medicine, and Technology at the University of London, and finishing it off before going to UAMS at our own National Institute of Health. here in the United States. So, doctor, exceptional background you have. In addition, you are one of the key experts in all of Castleman's disease. And those 200 people who get that every year, I'm sure are very happy to have you in their corner, given what I've read about some of the wonderful things you've done for people with that disease. So, doctor, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for the wonderful introduction, and I will try to live up to it.
I think you will, without doubt. First, I'd like to ask a few questions, and I had several, but I think I'm going to whittle it down to just three for the introductions, because the panel has introduced so many great questions that we'll get to them with their questions a little bit quicker. And so, Dr. Van Rie, would you provide us a little background on the UMS Multiple Myeloma Program and in this concept of total therapy?
The myeloma program here was started by Dr. Barlagi in 1989. He came originally from Germany and worked at MD Anderson and started treating myeloma patients here in Little Rock, Arkansas. He uses a concept which is called total therapy, which applies all available drugs up front in combination with stem cell transplantation. The development of total therapy is based on the concept which St. Jude's Children's Hospital has developed for the treatment of acute childhood lymphoblastic leukemia. There they used induction chemotherapy to get the disease under control. Later consolidation was added, and then maintenance. We used a similar concept in the care for myeloma with the addition of stem cell transplantation. A melphalan-based stem cell transplant is a way of getting a patient into complete remission. It's estimated that a single transplant will induce a complete remission rate of 20%. The concept of doing two transplants in multiple myeloma was again modeled on acute childhood lymphoblastic leukemia, where cures were seen when the CR rate, the complete remission rate, was 40%. So the idea was if we do two transplants in a row, we get 40% of patients in remission, and perhaps we're going to see some cures. So that's where the concept of tandem transplantation comes from. And again, there is upfront induction chemotherapy. Then in analogy to childhood acute lymphoblastic leukemia, there is consolidation dose-reduced chemotherapy post-transplant. And again, there is a maintenance phase to suppress and eradicate any residual disease. Over the years, we gradually introduced new drugs, including thalidomide, later bortezomib, and also lenalidomide. The other aspect, I think, which is unique of the total therapy concept and the Arkansas program, that we do try to follow patients very long term. So we have a unique long-term follow-up. We like to think that we provide care from the cradle to the grave, so to speak. We have been following our patients in a comprehensive fashion, introducing cytogenetic testing at the onset of the program, MRI shortly thereafter. We introduced gene expression profiling on all patients in the year 2000, and shortly thereafter assessment by PET scanning as well. So these are sort of the unique features of total therapy and the program.
You said a gene expression profiling. How does your treatment, how is it impacted by gene expression profiling?
Dr. Shaughnessy, who used to work at our institute, developed a gene expression score based on the expression of 70 genes, which were either overexpressed or underexpressed in myeloma, and separate the patients into two groups. At diagnosis, 85% of patients have standard or low-risk disease, and 15% have high-risk disease. We have found that with the in our Total Therapy 3 program, we made substantial progress with the introduction of bortezomib in the standard or low-risk group, but not in the high-risk group. The high-risk group is characterized by an increased propensity to relapse. In other words, patients will go into remission with equal ease, but have a higher relapse rate than standard or low-risk patients. So based on the observation that in the Total Therapy 3 program, patients with high risk fared significantly worse. We've developed two different treatment programs. One is called Total Therapy 4 for standard or low risk, which is essentially based on our prior Total Therapy 3 approach. And a different approach, a different protocol for patients with high risk disease. In other words, the gene expression profile score being high or low risk assigns patients to a different treatment program.
I see. Very good. One thing I'm sure you're aware of is that your program does have some of the very best survival statistics in the country. However, it also seems to be under fire sometimes for being too aggressive, and sometimes the quality or the integrity of the data is often questioned. And I believe most of your survival data comes from clinical trials, and it was my understanding that clinical trials and the data from the clinical trials are audited by outside firms to ensure accuracy. So can you comment on that and give us your perspective?
Certainly. There is in the myeloma community the debate versus of treating patients to control the disease versus cure. In my view, both approaches are not mutually exclusive. I think it would be unreasonable to give a 78-year-old person highly aggressive therapy, and there it would be very reasonable to control the disease. On the other hand, in a younger patient where you really want to have long-term outcome, more aggressive therapy can induce long-term remissions and potentially cure of the disease, and that's where you would treat more aggressively, in my view. With regards to the integrity of the data, I believe that we are the only program who actually audits our own data. We have an independent auditing team coming in two or three times a year, and they've audited us 25 times since 2005, starting with our Total Therapy 2 program. 78% of the patients in Total Therapy 2 were audited, about 90% of patients in Total Therapy 3, and in the order of 55 to 60% of patients in Total Therapy 4 and 5 have been audited. In addition to that, we have had FDA audits in 2004, 8, and 2012. And we also have an internal compliance office at our institute which audits as well. So these data are truly very rigorously scrutinized.
Well, thank you. And one last question from me, and then I'll open it up to the panel. The evolution of the TT program seems to add new drugs, yet the intensity of the treatment has been reduced, meaning that I think there's one induction now in TT4 and one consolidation. And also the melphalan is now reduced dose in like three times or something similar to that. And even though the intensity has reduced, these new drugs apparently have significantly improved survival. As a matter of fact, I did a little data mining myself, and according to TT1, the six-year survival was 50%. TT2 without thalidomide, it was 58%. TT2 with thalidomide, so you have an IMID, it's 62%. And then TT3, which included bortezomib, or a protease inhibitor, was 70%. So you're 1.7 times more likely to survive if you've had TT3 than if you've had TT1. So I think that's quite significant, and that leads me to the question, what do you see the next steps in the progression of the TT program? Carfilzomib, pomalidomide, monoclonal antibodies, or vaccines? Where are you going with your next step, and what is that next step that you see?
So confining ourselves to the high-risk patients, I think we've developed a different protocol, which is called Total Therapy 5 for high-risk patients, which is a little bit modeled on how some German groups have treated a very aggressive lymphoma, which is usually treated with a combination chemotherapy called R-CHOP. And they apply that chemotherapy more frequently. So what we have done in Total Therapy 5, we treat patients at six-weekly intervals with combinations of drugs. In other words, we reduce the treatment-free periods, but we de-escalate the dose. In other words, the patients get more frequent therapy, but the doses are less. The idea is that during the treatment-free periods, there is no regrowth occurring of the myeloma. In other words, we keep tumor kill ongoing, and we've observed that with that approach, patients go quicker through the treatment program. Up until the maintenance phase, they do better, but relapses occur during the maintenance phase. Let me look at our Total Therapy 5 program, in which we use what we call a dose dense, that is, giving the chemotherapy closer together approach. We found that the overall survival was better, and we think that the overall survival is better due to the appearance of new drugs on the market. In other words, the survival was better because when patients relapsed, we had better salvage. And the drugs that we use, particularly in that period of time, is carfilzomib. And we have now a new version of Total Therapy for Total Therapy 5, which is hopefully going to be activated within the next 3-4 weeks, in which we're going to use carfilzomib instead of bortezomib during treatment for high-risk patients. Substitution of bortezomib for carfilzomib, we hope may improve the outcome in the high-risk setting. I think in the patients with low-risk disease, we need to try to figure out exactly who benefits from what. We have been criticized for being too aggressive. Our maintenance is for 3 years with bortezomib, revumenib, and dexamethasone. Some people comment that we don't use maintenance but extend the treatment for 3 years. And then the question arises of who exactly needs which drugs. we have some clues who may benefit from certain drugs. Total therapy 2, we did not have bortezomib available. And we found certain molecular subgroups which clearly benefited a lot from the introduction of bortezomib. These are patients with the 414 translocation, patients with deletion of P53, patients with hypodiploid cytogenetics. So we are able to see the patients who benefit from proteasome inhibition, and perhaps we can also see that other patients who perhaps have more genomically stable disease might not need Velcade and perhaps could benefit from a more immunomodulatory approach. That would be combination of an immunomodulatory drug, for instance, with a monoclonal antibody, and the two would work synergistically, or a combination of of an immunomodulatory drug with a vaccine. So those are thoughts we have currently on how to develop the approach for the standard or low-risk group.
Well, thank you so much, Doctor. You've done an excellent job of explaining the program, and I think I'd like to ask some of the people on our panel to ask their questions. Nick Van Dyke, yours, first question, and we'll do it one question at a time.
Perfect. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, you're very well.
Excellent. So, first of all, hello, Dr. Van Rie. My questions tend to be long, and today's unfortunately going to be no different. As many listeners are likely aware, I am a patient and, dare I say, even a friend of Dr. Barlaghi's, and I'm a pretty fierce proponent of your work. So, first of all, I want to thank you and your colleagues for saving my life. I was diagnosed 5 years ago at the age of 40, so I was definitely in the young and want to get rid of it type of cohort. Having said that, you sometimes get the toughest questions from the ones you love, and so this is going to be a tough question. Total therapy, as you mentioned, from its first trials, looked to stuff like pediatric ALL, where you observed a plateau of remission loss. In other words, after some period of time in remission, the likelihood of losing it goes to nearly zero. And on that basis, you saw successive plateaus in total therapy 1 at maybe 15 or 20 years out, and total therapy 2 much closer. And initially, I read a presentation that you published a few years ago called The Myth of Incurability that suggested the plateau for total therapy 3 would be around 6 years out. In other words, if you lasted 6 years, you could be relatively certain that the disease wouldn't be coming back. And then this further got updated in a presentation called Modeling for the Cure in 2009 that showed an extraordinary number. If you were a low-risk patient, which is about 80% of patients, and you achieved complete remission, which was about two-thirds of those people, that 90% of that group could expect to be cured. However, neither of these presentations are found on the website any longer, and I know that Dr. Barlaghi is now testing whether or not prolonged Revlimid maintenance could make a difference in outcome. So I'm wondering, what's our current thinking on the plateau? How long does one need to be in remission in order to feel secure that they're likely cured, and what percent will reach this?
I think the inflection point of the curve, of the survival curve, you correctly pointed out, did go becomes progressively shorter with total therapy 1, 2, and 3. And it does appear to lie currently around 7-8 years on total therapy three. The fact that late relapses may still at times occur can be expected, even if patients are potentially cured. It's well accepted in diseases like acute myeloid leukemia and Hodgkin's disease, etc., that late relapses occasionally do occur. We do think that the data are holding up. The more mature data suggests that about we suspect that the overall survival rate at 13 to 15 years will be in the order of 50%.
And that's with all comorbidities from other ailments, right?
Correct, yes.
Got it. I don't want to cheat, but I've got one quick follow-up that I'd like to lob in, if you don't mind, Jack.
Go for it.
I'm going to charge in since Dr. Van Rie was made quick business of the first one. So I'm 4 years in complete remission, and UAMS has a highly sensitive test for minimal residual disease, which I'm sure we'll discuss, and I'm negative for that. But I developed a monoclonal light signature under immunofixation about 4 months ago, and Dr. Barlogy said he didn't know what this meant. I've subsequently looked into some Mayo research, and they've looked at about 2,000 patients and have seen that about 35 to 40% of patients otherwise in remission do develop what they call a secondary MGUS, and that this is actually associated with a much better overall survival because they postulate that much like oligoclonal bands, this is a immune system rebuilding itself. I'm curious as to whether or not you've seen that at UAMS. I would have expected that this would not have caught Bart by surprise, and I've encountered a number of other people with a similar situation, so it's not just my own biology I'm asking about, but it does seem like this would be something you'd be noticing there, and I wonder if you thought you had any prognostic insight as to what it might mean.
We have not done a systematic analysis of the oligoclonal bands. If you look at the Mayo paper in detail, it appears that they have a mixture there of patients with oligoclonal bands and patients who have MGUS reestablishment after their after treatment for their myeloma. We've seen that here as well. We call it MGUS-like myeloma. In other words, patients who have a preceding MGUS get treated for their myeloma, and MGUS remains. Then there is the issue of the oligoclonal bands. Oligoclonal bands usually means that there is immune reconstitution, and you will see recovery also of uninvolved immunoglobulin, and that's generally considered to be a good feature and have a positive impact on outcome.
So in the MGUS, like the people that are treated and then develop MGUS, do they achieve complete remission and then lose it to this MGUS, or does that MGUS eventually go away?
Usually,
and is it the same M protein? I mean, obviously that's the key question. Can it be immunophenotyped against the original presenting protein?
The patients that we call MGUS-like myeloma have the same original M protein.
Got it.
Usually the MGUS persists. In other
Got
words, it doesn't disappear. The oligoclonal bands obviously is a different situation. Usually there's long follow-up the oligoclonal bands because there is immune reconstitution occurring. The oligoclonal bands eventually disappear. But
Got
the
it.
Oligoclonal bands we see quite frequently here.
Got it.
Next.
Okay. Thanks for indulging
okay.
me.
Hey, Jack. It does seem like Dr. Van Rie is doing a really good job of knocking through these questions, so why don't you ask both of yours?
Okay, I will. Dr. Van Rie, I was had total therapy treatment in 1996, and there was no radiation involved, and the only maintenance was interferon, which was a blast for all. But my complete response only lasted for 18 months. And yet I'm still alive today because I ultimately had a full allo. So my question in these stats that, for example, was mentioned at the beginning of a median survival of 15 years for total therapy, would I be counted in that overall survival?
Yes, like in any study, overall survival includes salvage therapy.
Right.
So, yes, you would be counted for overall survival. You would not be counted, obviously, if you have a recurrence of disease in progression-free survival.
Right. Okay, that's what I thought, and I just want to make sure that's how it's done. And then, as I mentioned, I got into a long-term remission from a full myeloablative allo in 98. But it's my understanding that Arkansas no longer does either full or mini allos. Is that true, or do they do it just as salvage, which was really salvage back then, too?
We currently don't do upfront allogeneic transplants. There was a time that we did a second transplant, a mini allogeneic transplant for patients with high-risk disease, and we did not see an improvement in outcome, and we did observe toxicities like chronic GVHD. In multiple myeloma, the anti-myeloma factor of the donor cells is more tightly linked to chronograft versus host disease, and it's also not that potent. So fully myeloablative allografting has actually been abandoned in myeloma by virtually all centers. A number of centers and studies have done an auto and a mini allograft. Some studies have shown slightly better survival for the allograft arm, others have not. I think that most centers not perform an allograft up front for multiple myeloma. One could make an argument that a very young patient with multiple myeloma, maybe in their early 30s, could be considered for an allograft, in my view. The way we define high-risk by gene expression profiling, that is a group of patients with usually highly proliferative, aggressive disease, and the anti-myeloma effect of transplant is not potent enough to overcome that. So apart from experimental studies in which one would try to enhance the anti-myeloma effect of donor cells, in my view, there's currently not a good role for allogeneic transplant up front.
But you still do it in salvage therapy?
We do not do it routinely in salvage therapies in rare cases.
Thank you. And, Gary, I have another set of questions related to ASH, but I'll wait till we go around again.
Okay. All righty. Pat Killingsworth, your questions?
I'm here, and thank you for joining us, Doctor. You've already answered a number of my questions. I was going to touch on the retrospective study that Mayo Clinic did on the large group of patients treated between 2002 and 2006, and they showed median overall survival around 10 years, which is similar to TT results, I believe, but TT seems to be easing up on the throttle a little bit with the intensity that they're treating patients, and I find it so fascinating now, having been a patient almost 7 years, watching the rest of the myeloma community move closer to what Total Therapy has been doing all along, and they're starting to advocate hitting myeloma harder up front. So it's interesting to see the two schools come together. But before I ask my question, do you have any thoughts on that? Does that sound correct?
I think that's correct. I think people try to presently do embrace more and more the idea of some form of induction therapy, a transplant, and one could argue about one or two transplants, some form of consolidation, and some form of maintenance. So a lot of protocols, studies, do have this sort of total therapy concept, albeit perhaps with different intensities of treatment.
Sure, thank you. For disclosure purposes, I'm a former Mayo Clinic patient, and I understand that treatment decisions are very personal, and I also understand why some experts and patients might feel that that giving too much therapy might be just as bad as giving not enough. However, I'm perplexed. I don't understand why your institution that's doing so much great work and has done so much great work is continued to come under fire. Do you have an opinion on So if you're, if your studies are so closely monitored and audited, and the results are the results, why do you think that a large part of the myeloma community continues to discount the work?
Well, I would say high trees catch a lot of wind, isn't it? And we perhaps and I think people also, in general terms, people don't appreciate how scrutinized these studies truly are. We really, no database is perfectly clean, but we really do make a major effort in collecting correct data and having it independently looked at. To the best of my knowledge, we are the only myeloma group who brings in an independent team of auditors to look at the data two or three times a year. So the data are very well scrutinized, and perhaps we haven't advocated this very well, or maybe this is not insufficiently known.
How about the sharing of the data? Could that be part of it? Are you participating in the Compass, the MMRF Compass program, or things like that? Is it that other institutions don't have access to the data?
Well, we obviously the data get published, and all our gene expression profiling data is publicly available. We're not taking part in the COMPASS project because our treatment approach is probably different. But we're always willing to share our results, and I think we publish frequently and present frequently at national and international meetings.
Well, thank you very much for dedicating your life to help save ours that words can't express how appreciative I am, and I'm sure our listeners are.
Thank you, Pat. Cindy, are you on the line?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You got a couple questions for the good doctor?
I do. Thanks so much, Doc, for what you're telling me so far. One of the questions I had just from listening to you is, I'm not quite clear exactly what gene expression profiling is and how that is different from other types of genetic testing. Can you explain, like, the difference between gene expression profiling and maybe FISH testing and cytogenetics to make it more clear to maybe some of the patients on the line?
Certainly. What is called metaphase cytogenetics, that means that you take a bone marrow sample, you essentially grow it in the test tube, and then you look at the chromosomes under the microscope. The power of gene expression profiling is that if the chromosomal material looks abnormal under the microscope, you can inspect all chromosomes. You can visually see all the genetic material. The disadvantage of metaphase cytogenetics, that at least in our hands, is only informative in about 30% of patients. That means that the myeloma cells will grow in the test tube only in 30% of patients. That is because the remaining 70% of patients, the myeloma cells need the bone marrow environment to grow. So in those patients, the metaphase cytogenetics are normal and non-informative. Only in patients with more aggressive disease, the myeloma cells can survive and grow in the test tube. The other test is called FISH, or fluorescent in situ hybridization. Essentially, what FISH does is take a specific probe or a number of specific probes and try to identify specific abnormalities. The advantage of doing FISH is that it's informative in all patients. The disadvantage is that you can only look at a limited number of specific abnormalities. In other words, you can look for a missing part of chromosome 17 or or an additional part of chromosome 1. But again, it's limited to what you look for, limited to the probes that you use. The gene expression profile looks at purified myeloma cells. It's informative in the majority of patients. And you look at the expression of all genes in the purified myeloma cells, and you can look at the expression level and see whether they're overexpressed or underexpressed, and you can build up a molecular picture of the myeloma. So it is much more sophisticated in looking at the expression and abnormalities of genes than the cytogenetic or FISH studies.
Now, is the gene expression profiling done just at the beginning of diagnosis, or is it done periodically? Is it like a bone marrow biopsy, or is it a blood test? Or
it is done. It's collected from the bone marrow. We do it at diagnosis, and we certainly also do it at relapse to see whether the profile has changed. We also do gene expression profiling on whole biopsies, that is the whole actual piece of bone which is being taken out, not just the purified plasma cells, and that is presently ongoing research.
Okay, thank you. I think I have a better understanding of that now. Another question I have is, I'm always concerned with aggressive high-dose chemotherapy protocols, including the tandem stem cell transplants, because of the risk of secondary cancers like the MDS or the AML. And also maybe sometimes it ruins your bone marrow so that you couldn't get other types of treatment. And I heard you say you have a lot of long-term follow-up on your total therapy patients. I was wondering if you continue to monitor them for MDS or AML or leukemia-like diseases, and if you've seen an increased number of that in your patients?
Yes. I think that's an excellent question, both in our center and in other studies. With the introduction of immunomodulatory agents, we have observed an increase in both what we call cytogenetic MDS, in other words, only the chromosomes look abnormal, or real clinical MDS, which occasionally transforms into myeloid leukemia. That incidence is low, but has increased with the introduction of immunomodulatory agents such as thalidomide and Revlimid. Patients are being monitored for this long term, and at the moment in most studies the benefits of using maintenance with an immunomodulatory agent outweigh risks, but it does raise the question how long the maintenance therapy should be. I predict that in the future we will see a shorter duration of use of immunomodulatory drugs.
So you're thinking that the increased incidence is due to the maintenance with the IMiDs, not the high-dose chemotherapies that are used in the stem cell transplantation and inductions that you're using?
Well, it may be that some patients already have some normal, in their normal bone marrow, not in their myeloma bone marrow, not in the myeloma cells, but in normal cells, already have some abnormalities which occur in MDS. Then post-transplant, the bone marrow functions on a reduced number of stem cells, and there's a greater chance that an abnormal MDS clone may emerge, and that may be facilitated by the use of immunomodulatory drugs. So that's our current thinking. We find that the infusion of more stem cells seem to be protective against developing MDS post-transplant.
Okay, thank you for that. One last question I have is there a total therapy white type version for maybe patients who are transplant eligible, but they might not be able, their bodies might not be able to take the full brunt of the total therapy program? And if there is, what kind of subgroup of patients would that be?
I think that's an excellent question. Obviously, not everybody is suitable for a total therapy approach. In those patients, we actually try to personalize treatment more. We may reduce doses of chemotherapy. We may reduce the dose used at the time of transplant. We may only do one transplant. Sometimes in those patients who are frailer, we would skip consolidation and give less intensive maintenance therapy. So we do, in frailer patients, try to tailor the treatment to the comorbidities that the patient has. And obviously, not every patient is a transplant candidate. And sometimes there are even younger patients with a lot of other medical problems who really should be managed with an approach to control the disease rather than a more intensive approach.
Okay. Thank you so much for answering your question.
Yeah, that as a follow-up to that question, and is total therapy, what percentage of your patients are on a protocol like that versus, you know, the total patient population? So for total therapy, 1, 2, 3, you know, it's about 1,000 patients, I guess, or so, right? So is your total patient population a couple thousand, 3,000? So are 30% of the people on total therapy protocol?
We enroll in the order of 30% of our referrals on a protocol. Obviously, our referrals are a mixture of newly diagnosed and previously treated patients. So roughly 30%.
And they can't be on protocol, right? They can't be on a total a TT program, at least off protocol. They can't.
We do have a total therapy program for previously treated patients. We call it Total Therapy 6. They get the same treatment as Total Therapy 5. The rationale for that is that patients who've been previously treated are enriched for patients with high-risk disease. The eligibility for Total Therapy 6 stipulates that patients must have had more than 1 month of prior treatment, but they should not have had a stem cell transplant.
Okay. Nick, you said you had you had another follow-up?
I actually wedged that one in earlier, so I appreciate the opportunity, but I've used my airtime up.
Okay, I have another question, if that's okay.
Sure.
So if I'm understanding correctly, since I am not a newly diagnosed patient and I have already had a stem cell transplant, would I be able to be treated at all at Arkansas, or are my treatment options from Arkansas out?
Now, obviously, we treat a lot of patients like yourself who have had transplant elsewhere, relapse, and then come to Arkansas for treatment. So we don't confine ourselves to treating patients who've never had a transplant. A lot of our referrals are patients with relapsed disease after transplant elsewhere.
But they won't go through a total therapy program? Would it be a different type of salvage?
It depends where you how long you relapsed after transplant. If you had your transplant 10 years ago and you've had a remission of 10 years, you could sort of start over again and give a more extended type treatment in a younger patient. Obviously, if you have relapsed relatively shortly after a transplant, we're looking more towards doing salvage therapies. In some patients, we do a further transplant. particularly patients who are longer than 3 years out after their last transplant.
Okay, thanks so much.
Priya, do you have some
questions?
Are you
Gary?
Yes.
I would, the audience, I would, if you have a question for Dr. Ranji, please press 1 on your keypad and we can bring you live on air to ask your question. I have received some of them. I'll ask them. One of our participants have written in asking, after fracturing my femur in June, I was diagnosed with myeloma. Since then, I have not had CRAB, but after radiation on the femur, my kappa light chains have shot through the roof and bend zones were detected. Now, I'm not sure of the next step.
So,
stem cell, transplant, chemo, and if so, what kind?
So if I understand, we're dealing with a patient who has who has fractured a femur that has been repaired and only has had radiation therapy, correct?
Yeah.
Sounds like it, yes.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it needs to be established that the patient has an isolated plasmacytoma, that there's only plasma cells growing in one area in the femur. In that case, he would not need any further treatment. If it's a patient who is fit and younger, then it's a patient we would consider for a total therapy type approach.
Thank you. We have another question. This person wants to know more about kappa and light chain numbers and what they mean.
Okay, there are two ways of monitoring myeloma in the blood. Myeloma cells are plasma cells, and the job of normal plasma cells is to make antibodies. An antibody comprises of two heavy chains and two light chains bound together. And that is the whole myeloma protein which you measure in the blood. It's referred to as the M protein or the M spike or the myeloma protein. Some patients have myeloma cells which only make light chains. And these cells have lost the ability to either make the heavy chain and put the four chains together. In those patients, you can monitor the disease with the light chains. Quite often, you find that patients have myeloma cells which make light chains and other myeloma cells which may make the whole M protein. So, in fact, you have two tumor markers that you can measure, the whole M protein and the light chains only.
Thank you, Doctor. The third question is asks, did the ASH meeting last week give you any hope for a cure in the near future?
First of all, I think that we currently already have the available drugs to cure at least some patients, which is really good news for the myeloma community. What I find one of the exciting things happening in the cancer field is the ability to manipulate the immune system. There are antibodies now used in solid tumors, which take the brake of the immune system and activate immune cells against cancer. This is something which is also now being introduced into the blood cancer field. These antibodies could potentially be combined with vaccines, or they could be combined with immunomodulatory drugs. So that's an exciting development. The other development, which is The other new development, which is earlier on in its clinical application, is the development of immune cells which are specifically targeted to cancer cells and are highly activated. And particularly in pediatric acute leukemia, there have been some very exciting studies conducted. So I think there will be increasing ability to manipulate the immune system in a way that is therapeutically very powerful. Then the other, I think, interesting observation is that we are better at predicting nowadays with which patients with very early myeloma, what we call smoldering disease, are likely to progress to real myeloma. And we can pick out these patients at high risk of progression, and they seem to benefit from early intervention, early treatment. So there will be increased interest in the coming years of treating patients with what is called high-risk smoldering disease at an earlier stage.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Gary, I think we have time for a quick last round if any of the panelists have questions for Dr. Randy.
Jack had another question that he wanted to ask about ASH.
Actually, Gary, mine was answered, but thanks.
Okay. All
sorry,
right,
I have a question. I guess it's not on total therapy, but a few of my friends have been diagnosed with, I guess, a very serious type of myeloma, the leptomeningeal myeloma, when the myeloma crosses the blood-brain barrier, I understand. And I understand there's not much to many treatments that will help with that. What would someone in Arkansas do with a patient that has leptomeningeal myeloma?
We would give them chemotherapy and inject chemotherapy around the central nervous system in the spinal fluid. Usually we use a combination of three drugs and a series of treatments. When patients have leptomeningeal myeloma and disease in the central nervous system, sometimes the blood, what is called the blood-brain barrier, is broken, and some of the chemotherapy can, which is given systemically, can penetrate there. It has to be said that myeloma in the central nervous system is a very serious situation, and usually seen in the end stages of the disease, and is very difficult to treat.
Okay, so there are some types of chemotherapies that can be directly injected into the central nervous system? Is that what you said?
Into the spinal fluid, yes.
Into the spinal fluid. Is that part of the nervous system? I'm not talking about biology.
The spinal cord lies in a sac, and the sac contains fluids. You can access the sac by going between vertebrae and injecting chemotherapy into the spinal fluid. And that spinal fluid surrounds the spinal cord and can treat the disease.
And would it be the same types of chemotherapies that are normally used to treat myeloma, or a whole different set of chemotherapies?
Typically what we use are drugs which are used in, one drug which is used in leukemia, methotrexate. We do give steroids, which is given in myeloma. Then we use a drug called cytarabine sometimes, and sometimes a drug called cytipa. Both drugs are not typically used up front in myeloma therapy.
They're drugs
more used for aggressive leukemias, and usually patients with myeloma in the spinal system I have very aggressive disease.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Doctor, thank you so much. It looks like we're coming to the very end of this. And my thought coming into this is that you are going to be exceptional, and you were exceptional. You did a great job. You went through all of our questions. I don't think that's happened ever since we've done this, and you were succinct, very to the point, and I think did a very great job of simplifying the TT program, or total therapy program, at Arkansas, and also answered a lot of the questions about why that tree is getting all the wind.
Well, I thank you for having me on the program, and it's a pleasure to speak to you, and I hope that we will have had many listeners.
Thank you, Dr. Vanjie, for joining us today. It was a pleasure to have you here. Gary, Pat, Jack, Nick, and Cindy. It was a great discussion, and thank you so much for making this such an informative forum. The audience, thank you for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us in the new year 2014, where we have lined up interesting shows for you. Our myeloma panel will feature MMRF on 28th of Jan, and our cancer and nutrition series, we have our panel with Dr. Donald Abrams of UCSF, and is co-hosted by Pat Killingsworth. It's been scheduled for 17th Jan. Please do visit yourpanel.carefeed.net for more information on our upcoming shows in the new year. To search for myeloma trials, please use MMRF's trial search tool at myeloma.trialx.com/ask. The link for today's show will be sent via email to all participants. Thank you. Happy holidays, and meet you all in the new year. Thank you.
Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy New Year.
Good health to everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks, all.
Bye-bye.
Bye.